Hello, and welcome to today's teleconference. At this time, we are currently waiting for all the participants to arrive. Thank you for your patience, and please continue to hold. Hello, and welcome to today's teleconference. At this time, we are...
Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started in just a minute. I'm Molly Marin from the New York State Response to Intervention Technical Assistance Center. We're going to just flip over here to our slides. And today joining us is Daryl Millard from the University of Kansas. Daryl is also part of the staff for the U.S. Department of Education Response to Intervention Team. So he's a true expert in RTI, and we're thrilled to have him join us today. Daryl will also be with us on November 12th and November 18th for two additional webinars as part of this strand. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Dr. Millard.
Good afternoon. So we welcome you to this set of activities to develop your understanding and some of your technical skills around response to intervention. To get a flavor of that, and particularly a New York flavor, one of the pilot schools from the Technical Assistance Center has prepared a video to give an overview of what this looks like in their elementary school setting. And I think it's valuable just to have that background of what the implementation looks like and hearing from that school's experience around RTI. So that's really where we're going to start.
My role is to ensure that we are implementing all of our programs.
Well, now that we've got a good overview from the Milton Fletcher Elementary School, we can begin another little deeper view of the foundations and those components that are important for RTI implementation. When we look at what we want to accomplish in the next, this webinar and then the two following, this will have that big picture look and some particular emphasis on the components around RTI implementation. And then you heard reference in the video about the importance of leadership and collaboration, communications, how that's changed in RTI. I think that's the primary focus for the second webinar. And then this third is a consideration of your readiness, of the planning that needs to take place within your school to be prepared and move ahead as Fletcher School did in our video. When we look more specifically at today's outcomes, the emphasis will be around the this rationale for RTI, which you'll see again and again emphasizes a prevention orientation. As I said, we'll review those RTI components, and then we'll look at how those get integrated within an application of school, as Fletcher demonstrated there. So if you ask that question, you know, fundamentally, what do we mean about RTI? Well, your Google search would reveal quite a few references to RTI, but the better one certainly isn't on this list, but that's Gene Lockerson, who's an emeritus professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, talked about RTI as real thoughtful instruction. And you heard references to the thoughtfulness in the video we just saw, how folks were using data in new ways, more consistently in making those decisions. So in this quick overview, I'll talk about RTI's responsiveness to intervention. And there the emphasis on responsiveness as opposed to response, because I want to emphasize that all of our students can be responsive. And what our role becomes is helping, you know, optimize that responsiveness. And certainly, also as was indicated in the video, you know, students learn at different paces, as you are so well aware, that we want a system, if you will, that supports their responsiveness and their growth so that, well, in a sense, they are achieving as well as they can. You won't find RTI on a shelf in a department store. If you did, certainly don't buy it. You won't see, options of various RTI kits, except you should see frameworks. And here the emphasis is on the prevention framework around the instructional and curricular decisions. So a preventive framework that helps us with our instructional and curricular decisions, and that those practices are based upon students' responses. Again, coming back to all students are responsive, we want to be sure that we are giving them the kind of conditions in which maximizes their responsiveness. Frequently, when you hear discussions around RTI, you'll also hear mention of four components, and those components of screening and some levels of instruction or tiers of instruction, generally corresponding to what we think of as preventative levels of intervention. And then the third component around progress monitoring, that is looking at student responsiveness. And then fourth, having very clear decision rules. So we want to ensure that student responsiveness is objectively measured and that we have consistent measurement so that school teams have an objective basis for looking at students' growth. Again, the emphasis not just an indicator of where the student is, but how rapidly, how well the student is learning and benefiting from our instruction. We look a little more carefully at a definition, and this was a definition that the RTI Center developed. While you can read that, I want to emphasize a couple words. One, that RTI integrates assessment and intervention. So here it is, seeing a close link to what we conduct as an assessment being linked to the intervention that's being provided to that student. And also the notion of the prevention system, that the multi-level system allows the student to move up and down depending on the intensity of instruction that he or she needs in order to show growth. So we want to maximize that student's achievement, and we also want to reduce those behavior problems. If we wanted to step back again and look at that big picture of RTI, it's making a clear match of our decisions, and that emphasis on our decisions for improving student outcomes. And so those are the decisions we make around the curricular choices, such as how we will go about implementing the Common Core State Standards, around the instructional decisions, such as grouping and the amount of time that's provided for instruction, the number of transitions that we have, and then certainly the behavior management decisions, all of which we would argue have a significant impact, the most important impact, on students' growth, on students' learning. And then if students aren't responsive, or they're very limited in their responsiveness, it really reflects on our decisions to make and implement effective choices. So we may have the best curricular options available. We may have the best instructional practices, but unless we implement those with effectiveness, well, we won't see the benefits as intended. Certainly when folks think about RTI, for some of those folks, they might think of it as that tornado blowing across the plains that might, in a sense, be disruptive to what's been going on in school. But I think you heard that also in the video. It's certainly a story that I've heard repeated in the elementary schools and the middle schools with whom we've worked as part of our assessments or as part of our development of RTI in various schools. A consistent message is that schools felt like, even though they may have been doing a good job, but that the even after 3 to 5 years, they're saying, boy, we've got a lot more growth. There are a lot of things that we can still improve in order to have better outcomes for those students as well. So if we want to ask the question, well, what was the initiative that kind of got us started? What was the genesis for the RTI framework? And fundamentally, it's that prevention is so much more effective than remediation. And so when we look at the public health model of prevention, and we say, well, we can predict who is likely to have a medical condition that would require an intervention. We can predict well who's likely to have some forms of cancer, who's likely to have some heart disease. And if we intervene, or if you will, inoculate those individuals who on our screening measures are at high risk, we can prevent that, and that's much cheaper. It's much easier on everyone. And we also know that even in spite of the best inoculations, we need to have strategies in place for those individuals who still encounter the difficulty. So for our perspective, we still need those levels of prevention in the school so that it isn't just on the classroom teacher, but who else can provide a more intense or specialized instruction for those individuals. Certainly, if you look at a hospital setting, clinics, we have general practitioners we have county health folks who spend a lot of time on prevention, but if someone gets ill, we know we need that specialist to intervene. And in the health field, we'd say, well, the most intense would be that ICU, that intensive care unit. So in schools, where I think sometimes our problems are less well-defined, or you know, what would be an effective intervention is less well-defined, we also have those levels of prevention that help us identify what will be appropriate intervention. So that's one side of the genesis for RTI is from the public health. And then the second is from the school-wide reform work, and that is helping schools meet their yearly progress, being sure that the data that's collected as part of those assessments are used well for improving instruction. And we realize there's increasing emphasis on accountability, often accompanied by a shift in staff. Certainly many of the schools with whom we've been working have seen reductions in staff, and the question becomes, well, how do we make this work with less staff? An RTI can help with those challenges when it's implemented well. And then a third framework around RTI certainly is helping us with disability determination. If you were to look in the research literature, you would see that the uses around RTI have been prevention, and Frank Valentino's study there in New York is often held up as the first of those research studies that he and Donna Scanlon conducted as being important and good indication that we can prevent early reading problems. The second use is to help those students who are having existing achievement or behavior problems. And then the third is use as a component of LD determination. There's certainly the strongest literature for RTI and are supporting its use comes out of that prevention framework in the primary school age youngsters as well. If we think about advantages, the literature or even the proponents of RTI suggest that RTI has several advantages. One, again, by emphasizing prevention, we help ensure that those students needing assistance are identified early and that those interventions are provided to them in a more timely manner. It's often contrasted with that wait-to-fail model. So again, if we're good at prediction of who's going to have difficulty in reading or in mathematics, for example, we can intervene much more early and begin providing assistance. It also helps ensure that students' poor academic performance is not due to poor instruction. We're carefully monitoring students' responsiveness, and when we see a lack of responsiveness, we can intervene as well. The assessment data are collected and inform us about teachers and other schools, if you will, curricular decisions as well as instructional practices. So in a sense, we have this test that continues to inform how well the system is working across the school, across all of our students as well. So by having that population focus, it helps prevent any of our students kind of falling through the cracks, if you will. And then we have interventions that allow us to make comparisons across their peers or the tiers of services that are being provided to them. If we come back, again, I'm going to make a pitch around the prevention approach. And this is some work that Joe Torgerson and Barbara Foreman completed a few years back. And they noted that students who are behind do not learn more in the same amount of time as students who are ahead. The catch-up, it requires significant increases in the direct instructional time, and that it's very difficult to achieve. So we also see this in the report out of Washington State that was conducted. So prevention helps us significantly in ensuring that students don't get behind. So here's, you know, staying with the numbers a little bit, we know that when students start school and when they end school, the correlation of where they are is anywhere from 0.8 to 0.9. And if one is the highest value, you can see that there's a very positive, very significant correlation of where students start and where they wind up. So the students who are ahead, they'll stay ahead. Those that are behind, they tend to stay behind, unless we're able to intervene. We can quantify that a little further when we think that each 13 percentile points from the 50th percentile equals about a year of growth. So we stop and think for a second. We're using those percentile scores, that if the state standard is, you know, the 50th percentile, if we have a student who's in the second grade and his or her scores are at the 12th percentile, that difference of 38 percentile points equals about 3 years. You know, take those 38 points, percentile points, and divide by 13, and you get 2.9, which is an awful significant deficit, particularly, for example, here for a student in second grade. We also know that for the student to make gains, on the average, you know, he or she will need 80 minutes of instruction a day. So you often see an emphasis on language arts related instruction being provided for 90 minutes. So here we're saying the minimum is 80 minutes for third and fourth grade, and that in order to catch up, again, for our student who's 2.9 years behind, you know, it's going to take 3 years and at least 240 minutes for that student to make the gain. So the total grade for grade 3 and for grade 4 is like that 400 minutes. It's a significant amount of additional instruction that's needed if we're going to help that student catch up to by the end of grade 4 and to be on level with his or her peers. So, you know, catching up places a huge resource burden on everyone. I think it creates a significant emotional burden on the student, the sense of failure, you know, the parents, and then on staff, if you can say, well, you know, we just can't do anything about it, right? It's just that way. That sense of very limited self-efficacy or agency. And then, you know, fundamentally, how successful are we with catching up students? The alternative is to emphasize that prevention approach so we can get out of this emphasis on remediation. So now let's turn our attention more to those components that are part of RTI. And on this slide, which amazingly is not showing up, it worked well in the rehearsal, but so that there are these four essential components around RTI. Let me just mention them to you. And in the next few slides, we'll work our way through those four. So the first essential component would be screening. So we want to talk about academic and behavioral screening of students. Because after all, prevention says we can predict who is likely to have difficulty. So we conduct screening to verify, to identify those students who are at risk. And the second component is progress monitoring. So that assuming we've identified students who are at risk and they are receiving an intervention, we need to know whether or not that intervention is working. To go back to our medical example, you know, if someone's in the intensive care unit, they're very closely monitored. Numerous telemetry and then observations from the nursing staff, for example. If it's less severe, you know, and you're you go in and see your doctor, and he or she prescribes some medicine. Well, they might say, well, let's come back after 2 weeks and see how that's working. Well, obviously, there's a significant difference in the intensity of that progress monitoring that's taking place as well. But progress monitoring informs us, again, about the accuracy of our decisions around curricular choices and instructional practices. The third component is certainly referenced in what I was describing as these multiple levels of prevention or tiers of intervention. New York uses 3 tiers of intervention. Other schools in which we worked had as many as 4, and even 2 of the schools had 5 levels of intervention, 5 tiers of intervention. And then, of course, there are many more variations in terms of eligibility for those tiers of intervention, too, across schools. But that takes us to the fourth component, and that is database decision-making. And that is, in your schools, being very explicit around the criteria for entry into, if you will, the secondary or the tertiary levels of prevention, the second tier or the third tier of intervention, and having clear exit criteria. That is, if we're going to include students with particular characteristics, when would we exit them? When would we say that the intensive care unit is no longer needed and that we can go to a step down level of prevention? So again, those are our 4 components, and we'll walk through those with more examples and details. But screening is number 1, and that's really the one in which most schools start their plans around RTI intervention. So screening, and then the second is progress monitoring, and the third was tiers or levels of prevention, and the fourth was on the database decision making. When we look to New York, as I mentioned, and you guys probably already know this, you have 3 tiers of intervention. Let's take an overview of those 3 and noting in particular how the intensity of the intervention increases as we move from tier 1 to tier 2 and from tier 2 to tier 3. So a consistent theme around levels of prevention is that they become increasingly intense as we move ahead. Let's look now more specifically at this tier 1 prevention. And here, this is associated most commonly as the level of prevention that occurs within the general education classroom, that the general education teacher provides strong, solid, scientifically research-based instruction that's aligned to the learning standards. This occurs year after year, and as I mentioned earlier, in terms of English language arts, we would hope that that's 90 minutes of uninterrupted instruction on a daily basis. Screening is integrated within this assessment, the screening assessment is integrated within this year-long program at 3 times a year, in the fall, in the winter, in the spring. And if it's just too much for schools to conduct all 3, well, certainly any would be better than none. And 2, in general, we would say would be a minimum. The example about screening and then following it up with progress monitoring shows the relationship of those 2 components. So in this example, students who are judged as at risk on the screening measure would be progress monitored on a weekly basis for 5 to 6 weeks. So they want to look at students' responsiveness over those 5 to 6 weeks to make a decision about, well, maybe it was just an off day for that student, or he or she just, you know, wasn't settled enough in instruction, particularly if we look at early kindergarten screening as well. The second level of prevention focuses on, or is sometimes called that secondary level of prevention. And here, someone other than the classroom teacher typically delivers the instruction. It could occur within the classroom, or often is not. The grouping is much more reduced in size as one way to increase the intensity of the instruction. So it isn't just who's delivering the intervention, but also we've shrunk the instructional grouping size from 1 to 3 or perhaps 1 to 5. There's some literature, certainly when Lynn Fuchs was talking about this most recently, she was saying, you know, what, for many of their primary school age kids, if you get a student with a behavior problem, then 1 to 3 is really a big number, because the task is to keep youngsters focused on the instruction. And the more of the behavioral intervention that you have to provide, then, you know, there's less emphasis on the academic instruction. So that's how you might consider varying the instructional grouping size. But again, recognizing that this is one of those ways of increasing the intensity of the instruction. And then that we're using scientifically research-based instruction to work on those deficit skills for the targeted students, that those students who are identified through our screening and progress monitoring as not making progress would have instruction in particular components in which they would be deficit. The duration for those intervention programs could be from 10 to 30 weeks. 10 weeks, you're lucky if that, well, lucky may not be the word. Maybe you're just really, really good. How would that be? If in 10 weeks' time you can catch up those students. But again, the notion is if we get those youngsters early, we may be able to. But also recognizing that the 30 weeks pretty much covers the academic year as well. Another way to think about increasing intensity of the instruction is the length of those intervention sessions. So here, it's 20 to 30 minutes and 3 to 4 times a week. So if we had 20 minutes 4 times a week, we've added 80 minutes of instruction. That's remarkably different than the 120 minutes I would suggest if you had for 30-minute sessions. Let's see, move ahead. And the question is asked, is the intervention session in addition to the 90 minutes? And the answer is yes, it is. Then the progress monitoring. Notice how we've stepped up the frequency of the progress monitoring to twice monthly. So, you know, alternate weeks, we're examining the rate, the level of performance. And you get there's I'll probably say this a little later on another occasion, but you need numerous data points in order to make a determination whether or not the intervention's working or not. So, you know, how much data do you need? It seems to be a minimum of 9 data points, and certainly once you get 12 data points, you're in a lot better sense of whether the intervention's working or not. So tier 3, or sometimes referred to as the tertiary level of prevention, the ICU, you know, here's where we want the most highly skilled, the most knowledgeable, experienced staff working with the students. And notice how we've increased intensity through reducing the grouping so that that instructional grouping of 1 to 1 or 1 to 2 to ensure that the intervention is very targeted and very specific for the individual needs of those students. And just as you would in ICU, you have very careful attention. So we have customized interventions, we have very intensity, we have systematic research-based instruction that targets these students. And the literature's clear that there are, you know, maybe 1 to 5% of our students who are going to need this kind of intensive intervention to be able to benefit, to survive within our and grow within our schools. This could, again, could carry on from 10 to 30 weeks. I would expect it's a lot closer to the 30 weeks than it is the 10 weeks. But again, maybe you can work magic and you have a very powerful intervention from with many components, you know, working together. And then the length of those intervention sessions, 30 to 60 minutes and 5 times a week. I'm really pleased, you know, that the notion of the 5 times a week, because it gives you a consistency in the instruction that many of these students, you know, it's a great benefit to their learning to have that kind of consistency. The assessment could include formal and informal measures, but certainly we want to collect those data at a minimum once per week. And again, that helps us focus on the specificity of the particular intervention that's being provided. So let's take a look at, again, one of the pilot schools. In this case, it's the West Street Elementary School, and starting at the bottom of the slide, that in, the general education teacher was using the intervention scripts, the reader-writers workshop, and 5 times a week for that 60 to 90 minute session. So this felt like strong core instruction as a foundation within the school. And then for those students who were identified in our screening or were not making the requisite expected progress, they went to Tier 2. And here, for example, they had more specific intervention foundations, you know, out of the Wilson reading system and guided reading for that 5 times a week from 15 to 30 minutes. I think that could vary. You know, kindergartners getting perhaps less time and those second graders getting more time on that instruction. And then their most intense levels of instruction being provided through that special education teacher or the instructional support. And again, a smaller student ratio, teacher ratio, and 15 to 45 minutes for 5 times a week. So to go into a little more detail around these four components, I think we'll give you more background on this. And in the area of good news, we know that screening can be very valuable because we can predict much better in terms of students who are going to have academic difficulties in reading and in mathematics. And we can take advantage of that, of prediction and being able to intervene appropriately. So here's an example. This is some of the work from Doug and Lynn Fuchs at Vanderbilt, where they were using a curriculum-based measurement probe. And what you see across the grade levels in the left-hand column, and then in the second column is what's the focus of that curriculum-based measurement probe. So certainly at kindergarten, we're looking at letter sound fluencies. Grade one, the word identification fluencies from a word list. As we move into grade two, we begin using connected prose. So we have passage reading fluencies, oral reading fluencies, if you will. And then for grades 4 through 6, you know, maze fluency, which you might think of as maybe a closed procedure where there's a word deleted. You know, out of every 7 words, one of the words would be deleted in that passage. And then the research that they've conducted to identify what the cutoff scores would be for reading risk. So at kindergarten, if those students aren't identifying 10 letters per minute, would be at risk, that the sounds corresponding to those letters, and then moving down the list as well, the 15 words on the list or 15 words in text when we get to second grade and then third grade and they move on up, and then in terms of the maze. So we have these indicators of screening practices for various grades, as well as what those cutoff scores would be to indicate at-risk status. The second component around progress monitoring, we know through an extensive history of research that progress monitoring can be effective when it's used, when not only is the assessment completed, but the results are used in making those decision makings. It certainly helps folks become more efficient in their decision making. This is an example I pulled from the RTI Action Network. If you're not familiar with them, it may be a good resource for you to consider. But here in the general education classroom, being able to identify across months what the particular standards were that were emphasized in the course of the curricular materials for those respective months, and then how they had developed measures of the students' competencies, of the students' learning in those areas. So we aren't, in this example, it doesn't link so much with fluency measures as the reading example did. You know, here we're back on reading, we're looking at fluency largely. And then here it's more in terms of the performance, do they understand those. Now, we also have progress monitoring measures that can be rate-based and follow a CBM, a curriculum-based measurement format as well. So I see a number of questions over that you're posing as well. Teresa's jumped in and answered some. Do they find the relationship of the student to the screener? Someone known versus Kathy's question about screening results and students knowing and not knowing the screener. I'm not aware of those results. Generally, in the schools in which we've worked, it is not someone who the student would know well, because screening, you know, you want it done quickly, and that generally means bringing in, oh, the school psychologist and the librarian and whoever else might be available to conduct those screenings as well. And certainly sometimes students do have to miss social studies or science or other specials in order to receive the extra instruction. So Eileen, in response, that there's a great deal of concern that the ability to benefit from those classes or even later subsequent classes depends on having a strong foundation in reading skills and math skills later. So it's very much seen as a prevention framework. The third component about the interventions being delivered across those tiers, and the advantage we have these days is the number of research-based interventions is growing, and that we can go to numerous resources, external from the publishers, and being able to look at what has evidential support. So the What Works Clearinghouse, which is, you know, within the Department of Education, or the Florida Center for Reading Research, or the Best Evidence Encyclopedia. The Best Evidence Encyclopedia has done numerous reports on reading and math and writing interventions, as well as just whole school reform. That's Bob Slavin's group out of Johns Hopkins as well. So those would be online resources available to you, to your school staff, when you are considering what interventions you'll provide at that secondary or tertiary level of prevention, and I suppose also the primary level of prevention, that they have scientifically based research, which of course means that there's been a rigorous and a systematic set of objective procedures to identify how well they work frequently in optimal conditions. But if the research moved into the school setting, one can believe that it would be similar to what you might observe within your school setting, and that's an important part of the validation process as well in determining appropriate interventions. We also know that not all of our students will respond to those standardized evidence-based interventions, or what we used to think of as, well, not used to, but you know, you've heard it talked about, a standard treatment protocol, where we're very specific in what we prescribe for those students. Some of those students won't be responsive, so we might move to that problem-solving framework, where we begin testing, if you will, the effects of changing pieces of that intervention. And that may be important for the 3 to 5% of those students who generally have been found not to be responsive as well. So the framework from that data-based individualization comes from the problem-solving framework, saying we need to be very specific about which component of reading or which component in mathematics that we want to address in our intervention work, and very deliberate then in the curricular choices and instructional practices that we'll provide to those students. So this emphasizes in this slide, you know, the ongoing progress monitoring that's completed generally within a curriculum-based measurement framework. And of course, if you know Doug Lynn Fuchs and their colleagues from Vanderbilt, you know, that you probably aren't too surprised about that emphasis on a curriculum-based measurement framework. Let's see, there's another question. Would you be able to comment on screening at the secondary level? Is there a tools that can be administered? Yes, there are tools that can be administered and are appropriate for the secondary level. And I think when we get to the resources later in the slides, if it's not mentioned there, I'll be sure and come back and give you that information. And let's see, do you have sources you mentioned and research based? Yes. Again, we'll focus that. And then moving from the intervention side, but very important element in the RTI framework is how you interface with parents, because for good reasons, parents are going to be very concerned about how is the school changing and how is that going to help my student, my child. When we conducted the study several years ago, about 60 elementary schools, we talked with parents, conducted interviews with parents in 21 of those schools, and their anecdotal comments were very affirming. Again, it's anecdotal, and certainly probably school officials didn't have us talking to folks who were, let's say, antagonistic about it, but you had the sense, anyway, that this was a school effect, and that parents felt like they were more aware. They felt like communication had improved, and they were noting more progress for their children. So they saw this as a very positive framework. Your New York Research Institute on RTI has put together a parent's guide. I encourage you to access this. It does two things, I think. One, it will inform you as an educator about the concerns that parents might have and might be bringing to you. So in a sense, as you design your framework around RTI, you'll be able to anticipate the kind of information that they may be seeking. And then on the other side, it just helps build that collaboration with the home front. From our work in the RTI Center, we develop three resources here on the right-hand column, and the website, the RTIforSuccess.org. And once you reach that website, there's a menu for resources, and then under resources is briefs, and you would see the three documents that are listed on the right-hand side. So more of the resources that would be helpful to you as well. And notice that one of those specifically focuses on middle schools. Then, as we come to the other resources, let's see, the one about, there was a question about secondary interventions, and in particular, the National Center for on Response to Intervention includes a tools chart, and the tools include reviews, that is, external reviews, expert reviews of screening measures, of progress monitoring measures, and of interventions. So that when you go to that website, you'll be able to see others' review on the qualities, not only in the sake of a psychometric, you know, quality, but also kind of the administrative side. What does it mean? What does it cost to implement? What's involved in implementing one or more of these measures? And that might be helpful for you. Then additional, webinars that focus on RTI at the secondary level. We've conducted several of those that are available for you to view as well. And what else? At the bottom of the screen here is the National Center on Intensive Intervention. And this center, funded through the Department of Education and Office of Special Education Programs, was specifically intended to look at improving the interventions for those students who have not been responsive and would wind up, if you will, in that tertiary level of prevention. So that's a primary emphasis of their work. That center's been in operation now, I believe, 2 years and developing materials for those students. Well, that kind of brings us to the end of that overview of the RTI framework. We look ahead to the next couple weeks. We have the infrastructure of RTI in the school, and then the readiness and planning for RTI. Knowing that next week is Veterans Day on Monday, that second webinar will be on Tuesday of next week in the same time frame. Let's see. So let's think about if we've covered the questions that have been posed. Here's some discussion about AIS and RTI. Some of the differences between AIS and RTI have to do with how those four components are all implemented and the levels of prevention. That is, the degree to which it looks like a prevention model, and that screening and progress monitoring are incorporated within those frameworks. But certainly it may work that well for you. Let's see. Other questions that are coming up here. Well, guys, it's got to be pushing 5 o'clock back there, so it must be. And it's been Monday, and nobody's mentioned any. There were no questions about how did Kansas City beat the Buffalo Bills or maybe that didn't matter to this audience at all. Well. question, is there a way to get a copy of the slideshow? Yes, it will be. Yes, it will be posted on the website. I think they're archiving it, and we'll make that available to you as well. Well, if you have other questions, you know, you could send them on to Teresa. You've got my email address, and maybe we would try to cover those, in a subsequent webinar as well. Looks like you have some Buffalo fans out there for.
Okay, and as a wrap-up, this is Molly again. We do have a webinar evaluation. If you could all please take a few minutes to complete that, we would appreciate it. And, Daryl, we thank you for a great job today. We look forward to the next two webinars.
You're most welcome, of course. Good. Thank you.